every person in every creative field, everyone who ever wants to achieve anything probably struggles with that same mentality, right? Sean, you probably have it too, right?
Yes.
We're constantly balancing this like gratitude for what we've achieved with frustration that we haven't met what we feel like is our potential, right?
Welcome back to another episode of the Making Magic podcast. I'm Sean Jay, your host, and I'm a professional magician, speaker, and 3D designer. And this is all about inspiring conversations with the movers, the shakers, the visionaries, and the makers, the wizards behind the curtain that make the magic for you. Now, if this is your first time tuning into the show, thank you so much for doing so. It really does mean a lot to me because I put a lot of hard work into each and every one of these episodes. Whether you're listening to the sound of my voice on any one of the popular podcast apps or on YouTube, hopefully you'll decide if you're a podcast type of person that you'll follow the show. Follow me along for the ride and leave a healthy review of the show. And if you're here on YouTube, feel free to give this show a thumbs up, comment below, turn on the notification bell, and subscribe. You guys know what to do because I'm all about getting your creative gears turning, and that's what this show is all about. Whether you feel like you're stuck with a certain thought pattern and you want to break out of your current thought pattern, if you feel boxed in and trying to be inspired to think in new ways, well, I've got some of the world's most creative people that are sharing their process with you on this show. So I hope you decide to join me on the journey, and I'll be releasing episodes like every week now. So I hope you guys are enjoying this stuff. So with all that being said, let's learn a little bit more about our next guest. Welcome back to another episode of the Making Magic podcast. I'm Sean Jay, your host, and I'm a professional magician, speaker, and 3D designer. This is all about inspiring conversations with the movers, the shakers, the visionaries, and the makers, the wizards behind the curtain that make the magic for you. So this is a special live stream episode. Thank you to all that are tuning in. We've got a chat box there. Feel free to drop some comments. We'll always like to hear your feedback. So today on the Making Magic podcast, my special guest is David Berkus. Now, David is an organizational psychologist and the author of four best-selling books that help teams and leaders do their best work ever. So, David, welcome to the Making Magic podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, this is going to be a fun chat. We're going to go deep. Since this is a creativity-themed show that I have here, I noticed that one of your earlier books, The Myths of Creativity, just goes into all of the research and science behind that. And so I thought you'd be a great guest. So here we are.
Oh, no, that's great. I was telling you offline, it's a book I wrote. Actually, it'll be 10 years old this year, in October of this year. It'll be wow. 10 years old. And, you know, it's sort of your firstborn, so you always love it. But the changes in the world and the landscape of organizations and teams have caused me to have to talk about a lot of other stuff recently. So I always love, like, hey, let's come back and talk about that first thing you did, which would be awesome. And, you know, there's some things to update between then and now, right? There's been 10 years more research into how all of this works. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, we're gonna go into that. So on this show, I always like to start off by asking the guest, you know, to share with us a story, just to kick things off. And you're very good at authoring books and creating talks for organizations. So can you share with us a story about the very first thing that you created? And this can be good, this can be bad, and funny stories are always welcome too.
Yeah. So I was thinking about this earlier, because it's your opening question. And I'm sure when I was like three, I created some terrible Play-Doh version of a truck that was just awful, right? I'm sure, but I don't have any memory of that. I don't remember any of that. So what the question actually triggered in my mind, at least the memory wise, is when I was, I don't even know how old, when I was probably seven, maybe 8 years old, my dad worked for Digital Computer. So we actually had in our house one of the first like personal computers. ever. Like black screen, green, everything was green, right? Ran on early precursor to MS-DOS, right? And the idea was basically like they gave it to him so he could play with it and understand this thing that he had to sell. And my brother and sister, I remember, used it to make like, I'm dating myself here, but you could use like the slashes and the hash marks to make like Christmas trees or other cool creative designs. Yeah. I didn't do that. For some reason, I wanted to make a book, but I had no inspiration to sort of write a novel or anything like that. So I actually typed a book that I had. I remember this. It was a children's book about Native American pottery, and I typed the entire thing on this I've heard Hunter S. Thompson always, you know, used a typewriter to type out all of the Great Gatsby because he wanted to. Not me. Native American pottery, apparently. But wanted to see what it would look like to like print up and then bind that whole thing, right? And so when I tell people like I always wanted to be a writer, that's what I mean. No concept of plagiarism at the time, which is exactly what it was in essence. But I still did it. I made a book using a dot matrix printer, some staples, and some text that I borrowed from a different book that was sitting on my bookshelves in my bedroom, right? And I thought it was interesting that I even thought of that, because when I was in high school and when I was in college, I'm an organizational psychologist by training, but not till grad school. I was an undergrad English major. I went to college to study English and creative writing, thinking I was going to write fiction, and I ended up writing nothing but nonfiction. Thankfully, I don't plagiarize like I did when I was six, but got my start in nonfiction and then flirted with fiction and came back, I guess.
Interesting. Okay. And
by the way, I have never told that story on a podcast ever. So,
well, you guys have heard it here first and only here. All the other ones that talk about it, they're copying my show. This is
yeah. See? Yeah. If it ever comes up again, but yeah.
Yeah. I told him I wanted the exclusive, and he's bringing the heat already, folks. And that book took about 2 years to print on the first printer?
I spent, because you could save documents, right? So I spent probably 4 days in the afternoons, like coming home from school, typing out this chapter book, right? I'm not talking about like kids' book with pictures, but like now I have a 10-year-old and an 8-year-old as we're recording this, and we have my 8-year-old's graduated into chapter books, meaning there's enough text to warrant chapters. I probably spent 4 days typing out this 2 or 3 chapter children's book about this whole thing. And then, yeah, probably an equal amount of time printing it all out. Especially, I had to do it in that narrow window between when I was home from school and before Dad got home from work. Because I think if he found out I was wasting printer ink and dot matrix paper and all that sort of stuff, he would have been quite mad. But, yeah.
Yeah, no, I was just thinking like from the limitations of technology with everything being so slow and slow motion.
Oh yeah. It was awful, right? But also fascinating, right? And I to some extent, I stayed fascinating with the publishing side entirely, right? And also using software to sort of improve that. I mean, fast forward into high school, I was that sort of nerd that did like newspaper editor, literary magazine editor, et cetera, anything regarding words and writing. But I was also the one figuring out like, hey, if we flip to this piece of software, we could actually lay out a newspaper online, like on a computer, and then print it out instead of the way they all used to that we inherited. I was the one that actually figured out how to saddle staple the literary magazine so it actually looked like a folded book, right? Like I always sort of played around with those little hacks. So yeah.
So you were an author in the making at that time, and did you find came back and influence you in any way, or subconsciously, or?
You know, I don't know. You fated to be, who knows? I mean, you know, the thing is, we all have selective memory too, right? Like, so I played basketball for 2 years as like peewee basketball and whatever. If I turned into a basketball, which I'm too short to do, if I turned into an NBA basketball player, I'd be telling you that story instead, right? So I think there's that. I think the other thing is that we can talk about this in the context of creativity in general. We tend to flourish in the areas we actually get support. So for me, it was like, here's this initial interest and skill. But then I also was introduced to it. I'm like, I had a dad who worked for Digital Computer at a time where most people didn't have a computer. I had like English teachers and the faculty advisor for the newspaper and all that sort of stuff that were supportive in me doing all of these sort of crazy things. So I had some level of space. Like when we look at any what we traditionally call a creative field, right? So English, but also music and drama, magic, etc. Usually you find in the story of people that survived growing that creative muscle, usually find supportive people. Whereas all of the people who say, oh, I'm just not creative, right? Usually what you find is they lacked that. They had a bunch of early on, let's say late elementary, middle school, high school, they had a bunch of teachers that just said, no, your job is to sit down, regurgitate the right answer, follow the order of operations I taught you to do this math thing, right? And give that information back to me. And that kills creativity because it lets that muscle atrophy. So probably even more so than like this idea that, oh, this was, you know, in the blood or whatever, or was early on interest in me, is the fact that what we get support on at such an early age turns out to be the muscles that we end up growing throughout all of our life.
I definitely can agree with you on especially that last statement, because I got my start in what I do very young. I was 12 years old, and very grateful to have had that early support. It was actually my mother that supported me wholeheartedly. And I don't know where the heck I would be without that support, because we certainly didn't have the money or the luxurious fancy things. It was literally just total bootstrapping. We're going to try this. We're going to do this. We're going to make this work. And support, yeah, I think, is a form of currency as well. You know, can't buy that.
Yeah, oh, totally. And yours was probably at a time too, like not to date you, but at a time where you couldn't just like look up on YouTube all sorts of different close up magic tricks and then how they revealed or whatever. You had to like order it from the back of Boys Life magazine, you know, and in order to do any of that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So boy, Boys Life magazine, that's a reference. I am dating myself again. Yeah.
yeah. There's Boys Life. There was the Yellow Pages. People were using those back then with me. Yep,
direct mail advertisement for magic kits. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So knowing, just like fast forwarding through your life and your career, becoming a speaker, becoming an organizational psychologist, obviously you have a lot of academic training and speaking experience. Is there anything with your journey until this point where it is now? If you were to go in a magic time machine and go back in time, revisit your earlier past, or anything that you would do differently to prevent yourself from making any of the mistakes that you made early on, like some big mistakes?
Man, I think probably patience, right? Like I'd have to think about big mistakes, right? I don't have a lot of like regret that I tried something and it totally failed, but the incredible value of patience. To give you an idea, so I graduated almost 20 years ago now, out from undergrad, decided this is the type of stuff I wanted to write, this sort of blend of social science and useful takeaways and all that, so that genre, right? Mm-hmm. I decided that as a junior or senior in college, so I knew, I need to go on to graduate school. So I went on, did a master's degree, started in a doctoral program. Then I started hacking the system again, right? So I had a podcast before it was cool. So like 2009, no offense, but like 2009, 2010, we started a podcast. This was back when we didn't have tools like what we're recording on now. I had guests call into a conference call line, and then I would hit *2 to record the conference call line. Wow. And then we would talk, and then it would email me an MP3 file of our conversation on the conference call line. And then I would put that into GarageBand and I would edit that myself. And then I would manually FTP it up through a program that is still on my MacBook called CyberDuck, where I would manually upload it into the cloud, then manually code out the RSS feed, etc. Right. But what I like to say is we started, right? I know. So what I like to say is we started that podcast. It was called Leader Lab. Until I got sued for the name because I didn't know anything about trademark law, but that's a whole other story. We started that podcast in early 2010, and we were immediately a top 50 business podcast on iTunes. We were the 47th podcast ever about business to be uploaded to iTunes. Like, that's why. It had nothing to do with the actual rank. But I still love to claim that top 50 title. And it took 3 years of doing that before that turned in, and building an audience and writing on a variety of different platforms before that turned into a book deal, and a very small book deal at that. And then, you know, for the first probably decade of my career, I consistently compared myself to the wrong people, right? To people who were actually 20 years ahead of me. And what I should have been doing is compared myself to the people who were doing it, you know, now, et cetera. And so, you know, I think every person in every creative field, everyone who ever wants to achieve anything probably struggles with that same mentality, right? Sean, you probably have it too, right?
Yes.
We're constantly balancing this like gratitude for what we've achieved with frustration that we haven't met what we feel like is our potential, right? Mm-hmm. And in that moment, I think that's where patience would have been really, really helpful. Where more of that kind of strategic patience of like, no, actually, I'm on the same path all of these people are looking up, I look up to are. I'm just making the mistake of comparing my third year to their 17th year, right?
Yeah, it's like automatic setup for failure. You just can't compare. It's impossible.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So, wow. Okay. So, follow, you know, just understand the value of patience.
We went deep fast. Sorry about that.
No, that's how I go. I go from zero to deep like that. That's the whole point of this show. Now, and this is good. This is good. This is not about what kind of pancakes we had for breakfast. I want people to like get some value out of this conversation. So you, again, you know, you're writing these things. I see you have an active newsletter on LinkedIn. Could you share with us something that you have created currently, something recent, like one of your favorite creations?
Yeah. It's one not a lot of people know about. In fact, I can tell you almost exactly how many people know about it, 743. I know because that's the number of people who purchased my totally botched project with Audible that we did in 2020. Okay. But it was one of my favorite things to write. So I'll give you the story, right? So the way it works in publishing is in nonfiction publishing, if you want to be traditionally published, and there's better people to interview if you ever want to do a difference between the three different publishing options. But what I was doing at the time is you write a proposal. You and an agent shop that around to various publishing houses. It's almost like a business plan, and your publisher is your investor, right? So you shop that around, a publishing company, we say, buys it, right? And then you have a deal, and then you go off and write the rest of the book. You haven't actually written the book yet. You go off and write the rest of the book, et cetera. So after I got done with a book with Friend of a Friend, which is a book about networks and connections and how all of those things influence us and what, I had this idea for another project about how we feel a sense of purpose and mission. And I wrote up a proposal, and my editor at the publishing house that I was obligated to shop it to first wasn't interested. So then I was like, okay, well, let's shop it around to other people. They weren't all that interested. And so my agent was like, what do you want to do? And I was like, I don't know. I was like, do you want to write a different proposal? No. And so I said, you know what, actually just like give me the summer to think about this and then we'll come back. And I ended up writing the whole thing over the summer. And what I realized that I probably didn't know, but my editor probably knew, was that it was only actually about 20,000 words. 20,000 words is not a book. I mean, it's like it'd be like Who Moved My Cheese length of a book. It's not a very long book, which it makes sense why a traditional publisher wouldn't be interested in it. But once I had it finished, we started thinking about what other formats we could do it in. And we did it. We pitched it to Audible, and Audible bought it. And so we did it as this sort of original piece that's only available on Audible. I was always super excited about it because I had to think not just about writing, but about recording. It was like going back to the old school podcast days with way better equipment than a conference call line. And so we pitched to Audible. And the reason I say bomb 743 bought it is we launched it February 28th, 2020. And I don't know if you remember, but about 2 weeks later, the world ended. So we had great sales and then nobody cared, right? And you could not get any attention about this idea forever, right? It really didn't matter. And what the world needed for me wasn't that. It was work on remote teams and some revisiting some ideas I had played around with in a book I wrote called Under New Management. So I had to kind of abandon even promoting the project. And so to date, like less than 1,000 people have purchased that, because you can only get it on Audible. It's exclusive to them, and less than 1,000 people have purchased it. But it's still one of my favorite things I ever created because it was like, I don't know what this thing is. Let me just start. And let me see where it all goes. And I've never actually done that before. I'd always written this long proposal about here's what this thing's going to be first before I wrote it. Instead, I did a little bit differently this time. And it turned into something totally different than what I thought it was going to be.
Wow. Yeah, that's proof that the magic of timing. Timing is everything. In that case, purely due to timing.
Yeah. And it ended up being a blessing in disguise, even the timing on it. I have reused some of the research and concepts in a book that I'm writing now, but it's always sort of funny because like your Kevin Kelly 1,000 true fans will actually send me messages about like, hey, why do you always say you're the author of 4 books? I've read 4 of your books and I'm always like, well, I don't know how to count this thing that we did. I really don't. Yeah.
3.5 books.
Yeah. Right. 4.5. Yeah. Whatever. Yeah, exactly.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Published works, published copyright yeah. works. It all counts.
It's, yeah.
But you can learn from everything, as you said, and it's informing the decisions, and you're able to pull material from that to this day. So on that note, your creativity book, the Myths About Creativity, there was something that kind of caught my eye just when describing creativity and the process, how it comes and how it goes. And sometimes it comes easier and sometimes it's just impossible to grasp. It's like climbing a greased pole. So just might as well ask you, in your words, how do you explain how creativity can come in one moment, like instantly, and then just be completely void in the next moment and just feel like you're drawing a yeah. blank?
Yeah. So I don't believe in writer's block. And insert whatever other creative field you would have there, musician's block, songwriter's block, magician's block, whatever you want to call it. I don't believe in writer's block. What I believe in is a lack of adequate preparation, right? So fundamentally, from a pure psychology standpoint, when people say like, I'm drawing a blank, I have no ideas, et cetera, what it actually means is you're not ready to get into what in psychology is called, we would call it like the idea generation phase. But the phase where you're not ready for what we would call divergent thinking, coming up with lots of different ideas around a topic. That's usually the first stage of a creative endeavor. And that's when we feel in the moment. That's when we feel like, oh my gosh, it's all flowing, et cetera. We know that divergent thinking only comes from sort of preparation. Do you understand the question or the challenge that you're trying to come up with these solutions in? Do you understand the constraints that you have to work in? If you have that level of preparation, I mean, I write nonfiction, so there's a lot of research about the stories I'm going to feature, the research I'm going to write about, etc. But even in fiction, have you actually mapped out where this story is going? Have you done the work of sketching out avatars of various different characters, right? Same thing in music or anything. Have you done the preparation work? And then if you have, divergent thinking is easy. If you haven't, then you get stuck there, right? Because it turns out that like a blank page is a terrifying thing. A blank canvas, dead air in a record, all of that is a terrifying thing because it can be so many things that we don't know where to start. But if we've done the research, then we know where to start, and that kicks off that process.
I see. Gives you a good starting point. Got it. Just because you're drawing from a collection of ideas based on your research, and then something will ping in your mind.
Exactly.
Based on that, yeah. And this is just something that popped into my head. What's your opinion on one of the things that really fascinates me is the concept of a vacuum. And that nature doesn't like a vacuum. And almost like the Lao Tzu, the philosopher, had a quote about, you know, it's not the wheel that's useful. It's the space in between the spokes of the wheel. I'm paraphrasing. But, you know, it's like, so starting with a blank, you know, that's another way of thinking about it. The preparation, for sure, I agree. Like preparation for a keynote, if you're unprepared, it's going to be absolutely terrifying. Or for any kind of thing. But then when something is just blank, sometimes like you have a notebook filled with ideas and maybe that can get confusing. So maybe I'm just missing the part that you were saying about divergent, maybe funneling and filtering those ideas so you can have a better starting point rather than be so disorganized.
Well, so there's, yes, a short answer. So there's two different elements. When we think from a psychological standpoint, there's two different elements of what happens before somebody sort of solves an idea or ships a product, et cetera. There's divergent thinking and then convergent thinking, which is where you're whittling through the ideas, combining ones that need to be combined, et cetera, right? And I think that the challenge is that when you have a totally blank slate, right? Let me back up. All ideas are combinations of pre-existing ideas, right? That's how humans generate ideas. We're not capable of what in philosophy might be called ex nihilo creation, creating something out of nothing. All we've ever known how to do is take existing things, learn about them, combine them, and create new existing things, right? Which is great. You can send people to the moon just by combining different ideas. So what I mean when I say lack of preparation, right, is if you're running out of ideas, you're really running out of things to combine it with, right? Really out of new combinations to make. And you, I mean, you see this in music as well. People usually don't start off with like, I'm going to do nothing. What they start off with is I'm going to write this type of song. And then they start thinking through, in music, you call them influences, right? But they're really just raw material you've copied and you've blended. And you eventually you come into sort of your voice, right? Writing, it's the same way, right? I started out wanting to be like sort of a low rent Malcolm Gladwell, but then I learned from this thing and this thing and this thing. As I'm copying all those, I write my sort of authentic voice, which took 10 years and 4 books to sort of develop. I'd imagine it's the same way when you are creating an illusion, right? You start off with a rough idea. I'm going to create this sort of illusion, so it has to have these sort of parts, etc. That actually is because ideas are combinations of pre-existing ideas. It's much more easy to make the combinations that create that divergent thinking. And if you don't have that, right, if you don't have all of those ideas, you'll never get into convergent thinking, which is where you're filtering through and going, so which ones work and which ones don't, etc. So you need that raw material, and that raw material only comes from preparation. So there's not even these two phases, divergent and convergent. There's a pre-phase where we're really trying to understand the question, almost understand, to use magic, understand the genre of that particular illusion, right? Yeah. And then what has to be in play in that. So, yeah.
Got it.
That's my long-winded. Short answer was yes, you're right. That's the really long answer, though.
No, that helped clarify it. Now I get it, and I'm sure the viewers and listeners will also understand that based on what you just said. So, which then leads me to my next question then. Would that explain where sudden flashes of insight or just random inspiration come from then?
Yeah, so it could. It could. And the reason is I say that. So all of us have had that sort of eureka idea, right? Mm-hmm. This flash of insight, this sudden inspiration, this Newton in the apple story, which is fake, by the way, never actually happened, right? Or Archimedes in the bathtub, which is probably fake, but it happened so long ago, we have no way of verifying. And all of us have had those, and so we resonate with those stories. What we actually know is, in addition to everything we talked about, what we know from human psychology is that these moments of what are called incubation can be really powerful. And incubation is when you literally set aside an idea for a time. I'm working on this problem. I feel stuck or what have you. So I'll set aside. And you don't have to take like a break. You don't have to take a rest. You don't have to go take a bath like Archimedes or sit under an apple tree like Isaac Newton is supposedly did. What you do have to do is shift your mind to something else. And something in your subconscious, if the subconscious exists, something in your subconscious clicks into play when you're doing that. Now, here's what's really interesting. We don't know what's going on in that moment of incubation. There's 4 or 5 different theories of what's happening in the brain that triggers that. My favorite is actually what's known as selective forgetting. If you've ever like struggled with a problem and you keep thinking of the same wrong answer, right? Well, problem is your thinking pattern is in a rut. And so you're making connections. All ideas are combinations of pre-existing ideas. You're making all of these different connections and you keep making the same connection even though it doesn't work. So selective forgetting is sort of a way of letting your mind, just letting those bonds between different ideas break apart, letting your mind just sort of forget all of those wrong pathways it used to go under. And then you approach the problem again with a fresh slate. Now, sometimes in some cases, that happens when you're actually not thinking about the problem. Something you experience triggers this thing that's been on the back burner of your mind and brings it back to the forefront. You go, oh my gosh, I see it now. Other times, just going back to the drawing board, just going back to the piano, back to the computer, back to whatever it is you use to create, sometimes just going back to that after a period of incubation is enough to still unlock those ideas. So you don't necessarily need to sit around and wait to be inspired. You just need to recognize that sometimes you need to incubate on an idea and then you can choose the time to come back to it, right? Depending on the size of small scale problems, as little as 5-10 minutes, large scale problems, a couple days, and then sort of come back to the problem. You don't have to wait for that inspiration. You can kind of force it, or at least you can force those same benefits of incubation.
And I've heard something along the lines of what you're just talking about people, right? You focus on a problem right before you go to bed. Just you really focus on it, and then you go to sleep, mm-hmm. right? That's where I guess the old saying, sleep on it, comes from.
Yeah,
and that.
Yeah, or who is it? I believe it was Salvador Dali used to take these little naps where he'd have a metal plate on the ground and a coin. I don't remember if it was a coin or a key, but something metal in his hand. And he would sit in the chair because as soon as he actually fell asleep, his, you know, his arms would go numb. And he'd lose control over what he was holding, and then it would fall straight down to the key, wake him up, and then boom, he would be like, okay, what was I thinking about, right? It's all a way of sort of, I mean, it seems a little extreme to me. I've never actually done that, I'll be honest. But it's all a great way of selectively forgetting, letting everything kind of whatever happens there happen, and then come back to it. For me, what I usually do is deliberately, like, when I write an article or when I'm working on a book, et cetera, there's a deliberate period of time between writing it and editing it, right? Sometimes if it's an article, it might be a day. If it's a chapter in a book, I'll wait a whole week before I'll go back to it, right? And then this is totally side detail. I'll always read it out loud so I can hear myself sort of saying it. There's a moment there where I'm trying to forget what's there. I think the reason I read it out loud is that we often read text in what we anticipate instead of what's actually written on the paper. And I want to know, what did I actually write on the paper? And then after I read it, I'm like, no, actually, that's not the best way to phrase what I was thinking about in the moment, right? I want that moment of incubation before I go back to the problem so that I can make it better.
Yeah, right. And because our brains, we crave new novel things all the time. We're programmed to chase novelty. Giving yourself that break is just a nice way to break free from all that tension just for a moment, and then your subconscious is working on that while you're doing whatever task. And when you come back to it, you probably also get inspiration. Your brain will kick in things that from the task or the experience that you just did when you broke away to bring back to that problem that you were in the middle of solving. I'm just trying to follow what you're saying. It's fascinating. It's fascinating. So there were a few myths also that you discussed in this book, the myths of creativity. And so, like, I just jotted down a few of them: the Eureka myth, the lone creator myth, the incentive myth, and the brainstorming myth. And it sounded like you may have touched on a couple of those or kind of hinted at that. So is there a simple and easy way that you can just kind of summarize what each one would be for those that are watching and listening? And yeah, in the book, of course, we'll go into more detail.
Yeah. So the Eureka myth is essentially what we were just talking about, right? We all have had these feelings of inspiration, like the idea just came to us, right? Which is always a weird way of saying it, because that implies that it was somewhere else and then it arrived, when in reality, like, all ideas are combinations of existing ideas. It was already in your brain, right? But that moment of incubation is what we're actually describing. When we accidentally incubate on something and then something in our mind causes that to click into play. What I'm actually more interested in is the power of incubation used deliberately, right? You don't have to sit around and wait to feel inspired. I think, you know, I always make this joke that if you think about the story of Newton and the apple, I was an undergrad English major. And in English, in storytelling, we talk about protagonist, antagonist, who's the one doing the action, who's working against the action, etc. If you think about the story of Newton and the apple, like, the apple's actually the protagonist of that story. Like, the apple's the one doing all the work. It had to fall before anything could happen, right? And so the weird lesson we teach people when we tell that story is like, oh yeah, if you're in a block, like, sit around and wait for something to happen. No, right? Incubation is fine, but have a plan to kind of come back to it, right? So that's that sort of Eureka myth. And we also sort of touched on the brainstorming myth already with this idea of divergent, convergent, but also that moment of preparation, right? Like, creativity is a process. It's a journey. It's an iterative process. I always tell, I'm doing this with my two boys now because they have, you know, English classes to the point where they're actually having to write lots of stuff and revise it. And that's what I always tell them, is like, actually, buddy, that's the trick. Writing is rewriting, right? It's this constant process of revision, reworking it, finding the problems, fixing the problems, et cetera. But especially in a corporate setting, we don't usually think that way. We think like, oh, we have a problem. Let's get some people together and brainstorm, as if, like, magically in one 45-minute session, we're going to stumble upon what ends up being the right answer. No, brainstorming is important, but it's part of the process. And we need to think about the entire process, or for our Canadian viewers and listeners, process, whichever one you want to use. Lone creator is a really interesting one. We tend to celebrate in history and in media and what have you. We tend to celebrate these sort of solo geniuses, these sort of lone inventors, et cetera, whether it be Thomas Edison from 100 years ago, Steve Jobs now, like, whoever you want to use. in reality, almost all of these people had teams of people behind them that were helping them. You can go far back as sort of Michelangelo painting the Sistine Chapel along with 13 other people, right? You can almost always find that team. And I get it. Like, the story's more interesting if it's one person against the world, but there's a detriment to telling people that story because it's not true, but it also sends this message that, you know, the Steve Jobs, the Sarah Blakeleys, right? These genius sort of people who come up with billion-dollar ideas are up here and we're here. I always need help solving my problems. Well, so did they, right? And so in reality, we're on that level playing field. Right now, like we talked about earlier, they may have had more supportive environments or whatever, but the point is, like, the ideas didn't necessarily come from them. And so if you feel like you need a team of people, if you feel like you need help, you often feel like you're failing. You're not failing. You're doing the exact same thing they all did, right? So that's the lone creator myth. The incentive myth is a really interesting one that really applies mostly to sort of businesses, et cetera. And that's that you really can't incentivize creativity. I'd be curious actually to get your take on this. A lot of the research from this comes from looking at artists and musicians and other people who dabble between their own work and commissioned work, meaning someone hired them to paint a painting or write a song versus they were just sort of playing around of their own interest. And you almost consistently find when you blind out, meaning you remove any information about two different works and then you present those two works to a rater, an art critic or a music critic, etc., almost consistently the ones that were non-commissioned score higher in terms of creativity, right? That when you give people an, I need you to do this and here's what good looks like and whatever, either something about the pressure of not making the person paying them happy or something about it makes it not as worthwhile. And so the reason this becomes a myth is in a business context, we often try and put performance bonuses and all this other stuff in play that really aren't the reason people did it to begin with. They did it because they love playing around in that field. I'm actually really curious on this because I know you and your story, right? You're a magician, but you also work for others to create illusions. What do you think? Are you more proud of the individual work that you come up with, the ones you keep close to the chest, or the ones you've come up with commissioned?
I definitely the ones that I came up with. I mean, I'm proud of both, but it's just, it seems to be like the biggest hurdle is overaccomplished when you're just sitting there, in my case, sitting there right here, actually, you know, soldering iron, all these things. And I'm just like, this is the intended result. How the heck am I going to get there? You know, maybe talk to some friends, maybe, and then just sit there and just write my ideas, do this preparation before the brainstorm. And then, yeah, so I mean, I have created something for my presentations that I give, and it uses custom electronics and all of these things. And I didn't create it for anybody else, I created it for myself. So I'm very proud of that. At the same time, not going to negate the work that I have been doing with perhaps the most creative mind in close-up magic. Feel very grateful to be a part of the team. So that's my take on it.
Yeah. Well, and again, it's not that you're not proud of them, right? But there's just something about kind of doing it for yourself. And the yes. reason... The takeaway, the implication is that often rewards that are celebrated after the fact, if you wanted to put any incentive systems at all in play, I mean, I'm actually, if we want to get into big organizational design topics, I'm mostly in favor of paying people what the market says their job is worth it, like pay enough to take the issue of money off the table and then find non-monetary ways to encourage them and motivate them. But if we wanted to design some monetary incentive system, an after-the-fact reward celebrating their creativity tends to work better than a pre-work incentive, if-then type of incentive, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's not that you're not proud of that work. It's just there's this really weird phenomenon that we, when we do creative work for the love of it, tend to produce something that's more creative. And how do you harness that when you're also paying people to solve problems, et cetera? You pay them enough to take the issue of money off the table, and then you create an environment where they trust that their ideas will be celebrated once they're done, but there's not an exact if-then system to game.
Yeah, because with an if-then system, you're counting on the other person expecting that bonus or that end result, and it automatically sets the stage for possible failure, which could freak the person out, and then it puts
right.
unnecessary thoughts in their mind while they're creating, right?
Right.
It's like, oh, if right, I don't exactly. get this right, I am not going to get the bonus, if then.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice. I agree with that. That's pretty pretty straightforward. So you had mentioned a book or a smaller publication, and you said it was like due to timing, it kind of crashed and burned per se. In your opinion, I mean, I wouldn't say so. I would say considering what was going on in the world, you know, that it's better to have something than sell nothing. Would you consider then? Because I talk to lots of smart people and successful people, and we always see the highlight reel. We always see the social media, and that's just always the best parts. But we very rarely see the fails. So would you consider that publication? If that's your biggest fail, then I would say you're a really lucky guy. Or maybe is there something else that just kind of blew up in your face? Or
I don't know that that's my biggest fail. I mean, it's hard, man. I've had so many failures. I've tried out so many different experiments. It's hard to know which one. I'll tell you, my most embarrassing fail is, so the business model of what I do is that you write books and you can make a decent amount of money off the books, but you make a whole lot more money when people then want to tap into your expertise. Hey, come to our conference, come to our company and speak on this, run a workshop for us on this, coach us on this, et cetera. And so remember that thing we were talking about earlier on patience? My biggest failures probably happened, my most embarrassing failures, let's use that qualifier, probably happened when I was most impatient. And I remember vividly, actually, at one point, before I even had a book out, I had a website out because I had the podcast, et cetera, and I decided to make this tab on my website called Speaking, right, which is about me and my speaking. Now, at the time, I'd probably presented like four times in a professional setting. But whatever, hey, this is what people who do what I do, so I need to make a page like this on my thing, right? Because I need to get after it. And somehow along the line through the, I don't know, the SEO gods or what have you, I got an email from one of the largest speaker bureaus in North America saying, hey, you know, we checked out some of your work, saw that you're a speaker, et cetera. We'd love to list you on our site. Now, behind the scenes, there's probably a similar marketplace for magicians. Like, there are places that book on behalf of a variety of people, and their website is just full, like thousands and thousands of different, or at least hundreds of different speakers, et cetera. It's probably similar in magic, right? And you can book whomever you want. And all they were really asking was about listing me on their site, not necessarily promoting me, et cetera, but just like, are they allowed to copy my topic descriptions or what have you? And I got so excited that I was finally interested or getting some interest from this group that I like canceled the rest. Now, nobody really knows this but me, but I like canceled all my other appointments. I spent like the whole afternoon and evening crafting out this perfect response to them and their initial like glimmer of interest in me. But I knew nothing about this world, nothing about the market. And so I look back on those, and thankfully, like, I don't know where this email is, but I think back on those moments and nothing in my response was of any value to them because I had no idea how this world works. I had no idea how the marketplace worked. I had no idea how the small network that was this world of speaker bureaus and professional speaking, I had no idea how any of it worked. And it was, I mean, I could only imagine a professional reading that email and clicking delete and never thinking about me again. Which is exactly what happened. That email went into the black abyss, never to return. I never heard back from them. Till about 9 years later, when the person who owned that bureau reached out to me directly and said, hey, I found out about your work through this person, et cetera. You know, I'd be interested in talking about it again. Now it's 9 years later, and I've done this a couple hundred times, and I know this world, et cetera. And actually, what's interesting is last year, they were the bureau that was like most, booked me the most, found me the most of, got me the most of their clients. I work with a couple different ones, but they were the most. And I've never told them, by the way, that whoever emailed me that I am, I've never told, and I can't tell you who it is because then they'll find out. I'm never going to tell them. But I kind of smile at that idea,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And again, so the biggest, probably most embarrassing fail, but again, that lesson is that importance of sort of like patience. We see who we want to emulate and we rush to do it without understanding the entire world that they're in. And sometimes you just have to be an unknown and do the little things. Sometimes you just have to do, you have to do the close-up magic to four people at the cocktail party before you're allowed, you know, on the stage with all of this. You just have to do it. You have to pay those, not pay those dues, but pay those dues because you're learning about the world in a way that when you're ready to get to the next level, you don't embarrass yourself like I did, right? And it just has to happen. And there's not really a way to speed it up.
Yeah. And right. The speed thing. Yeah. Everybody wants instant anything. And we all need to just neutralize those expectations for a minute and just like separate ourselves from the ego for a second and be like, okay, what am I really offering? Where am I really along my journey here? Where I think I am or where I really am?
Right. And where would somebody who really knows the whole industry, right, where would they place me? Because acting like you're further along in your development journey than you are to someone who is further along is the surefirest way to look like an amateur, right? Is to think you're a bigger deal than you really are.
And that's so, a big problem.
I mean, I actually even have this conversation now. Like I probably underprice myself when it comes to speaking and consulting and all of that sort of stuff. And it's because I'm like, I don't want people to think I think I'm a bigger deal than I would much rather have them be like, oh my gosh, that was amazing. I wasn't expecting as much as you delivered than have them be like, well, that guy thinks a lot of himself and he wasn't really worth it. Right. So, but I learned that lesson the hard way, to be totally honest.
No, I think eventually people should raise their prices if they're delivering the value and the market will bear it. But I think it is definitely a better position to be in rather than disappointing someone, because certainly the higher the price, the greater the expectations that the client will most likely have. Oh, we're paying X amount for this guy, he better be good. So, yeah. Set the bar low and then over-deliver, blow him out the water, and that is most likely big part of the reason why you've had the success that you've had in the industry. You're constantly over-delivering on your value.
No, well, thanks. Hopefully over-delivering. Yeah, for sure. That's the goal, at least.
Yeah, it comes through in when we're having the discussion. You know, this is something you're very passionate about. So what about if there has ever been something that you were working on, maybe a publication, a talk, a workshop, and this was something that just was born out of an accident, like you were tinkering with an idea, and then it turned out to be totally amazing, and then it just stuck with you. So performers, you don't have to be a performer, anyone who does repetitive anything, right? We have our process, and then there's times where, for instance, if we're writing something with a pen, and we write something and our hand slips and it writes this weird mark. And then you go, wait, you know, actually that could be my logo or something. And then it's like, that's your logo. And it's a big part of who you are.
Actually, I'll tell you what, let's finish the story, shall we? Okay. So where we last left our hero on the second biggest failure, he published an original with Audible just before the world ended and less than 1,000 people have ever bought it. And that should have been the end, because I walked away from the publisher that I had a relationship with. I walked out into the ether. Nobody wanted this idea. I put it out into the world and then it totally bombed. So who would take a bet on this person who failed? Even though there were external circumstances explaining the bomb, like who is willing to take a bet on this person? Well, what I didn't tell you is that publisher was also the publisher of a book I wrote in 2016 called Under New Management. And Under New Management, again, I'm an organizational psychologist by training. It wasn't about creativity, but it was actually an attempt to answer. It was the follow-up book to Myth of Creativity. It was an attempt to answer, like, how do you design a work environment that is most conducive to creative and innovative people? And so I started looking at all of these different policies and procedures. And so we examined unlimited vacation. What is that all about? And what is it about? I'm most known here. There was a TED talk that I gave on salary transparency. Like, let's just eliminate all of the secrecy around money and let's just make it clear as a team who's getting paid for what, so we know what value to expect to people and does that work better or worse. And we looked at each trend along these sort of creative workplaces and then said, what does the research say? And some of them we didn't say were a good idea. Like we have a whole chapter before the pandemic, certainly, but even before the pandemic, there were rumblings about how much of a distraction factory working in an open office was. Well, we were looking at data in 2015, 2016 and suggesting this is a terrible idea. And snuck into that was this one chapter about more self-managed teams and not needing to see your team every day and diving into some research about, hey, isn't this crazy? There are 1,000 person companies that have zero headquarters that work fully remotely all over the world, et cetera. Well, fast forward a couple months into the global pandemic, the editor of that book, who rejected the idea that became the thing with Audible that totally failed, emails me and he goes, hey, I think this working from home thing for a lot of people, it's going to be a long-term thing, not like a 2 or 3 week thing. Do you remember when we wrote about that chapter in the other? Do you think you could make that like a whole book? Because I feel like there'd be a need for this in the world right now. Right. And so I hinted at that earlier when I said the world kind of needed me to write some different stuff. That became the book Leading from Anywhere, which is my fourth book or fourth and a half book, depending on how you count. It was all about, basically, I went back to those same people I interviewed for that chapter and then went back into all the research, et cetera. So, I mean, it wasn't an accident. Like, I didn't accidentally type out an entire chapter about remote work and self-managed teams and all of this sort of stuff. But it was like I was throwing spaghetti against the wall, trying to look at every workplace trend out there and make a judgment call on it. And it was one that I just thought at the time, 4% of the American workforce worked remotely, right? So it was like, this is an interesting idea, has some pros, has some cons, thought you should know about it, the end. And then the world sort of decided, no, actually, that's the most valuable chapter in the book.
That's the beginning. Right?
So, yeah. So, you know, wasn't an accident, but I didn't time it at all, right? There's another funny thing in there. When I screamed about open offices in 2016 in that book Under New Management, I looked at a lot of research that suggests that people who work in offices, open offices with no you know, doors to close, et cetera, just cubicle after cubicle, they get sick much more often. They get respiratory viruses much more often, right? I had no idea that 4 years later we were going to be thinking about space and air circulation to a level that we've never thought about as a society. So again, dumb luck. I don't know, so maybe not totally by accident, but it was definitely dumb luck.
Wow. Yeah. So it was a blessing in disguise, because it's basically a story of how your biggest fail or one of your biggest embarrassments set the stage for a success of a new book. And that's so, I love hearing stuff like that. You put something out there and you're like, you have your agenda. And you go, yeah, my agenda, I want this to be sell X many copies. And then it doesn't meet your standards. And you go, I guess it didn't work. And then you get this call and it's like, you know, this little piece does work. And then it blows up to be the next. That's so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, fast. What's that old cliche? Like, if you want to make God laugh, make a plan. Right. Or there's that sort of Chinese myth about the farmer whose son, like, breaks his leg, falls from a horse, and they're like, oh, that's unfortunate. And he's like, well, we'll see. And then 3 days later, the army comes, and because his son is injured, they don't conscript his son to fight in the army. So they're like, oh, good thing he broke his leg. And the farmer just goes, we'll see. Like, you never really know how the story is going to end. You just have to kind of do your best, play the hand you have, but recognize, you know, in the end, I didn't have any control over the fact that I decided to release a book in audio-only format at a time where everyone's commutes and drives to work and everything where they would have listened to an audiobook disappeared. Mm-hmm. I didn't have any control of that. I still think I made the right call. I still think just playing to that format, had that unforeseen circumstance not happened, it would have been great. But, you know, I don't control that. So I don't have any regrets about it.
And you probably wouldn't have had that next book either had you not done it that way.
Oh, no. Yeah, no. In fact, probably the worst thing that could have happened was a modicum of success around this idea. But I look back and I go, I don't actually see that as the idea that would have really scaled and really created the demand I needed in the marketplace and that sort of stuff. So, you know, if I had had a little bit of, if I had had enough success that convinced me to stick with that idea, I'd still probably be trying to shove that idea on people.
Mm. So that brings us to a point to where I always like to ask the guest, as we kind of funnel down, as we go divergent with our conversation, what, David, inspired you to do what you do?
The line I always like to use is that my goal is I'm trying to, like, the fancy way, you said it in the intro, is trying to help leaders and teams do their best work ever. The truth is I'm trying to make work not suck. Right? Like, most work is too central to all of our lives to have so many people who work in a crappy environment, right? I make a joke on these shelves behind me. For those of you that are watching, if you're listening, you'll just have to know. I have a red stapler, like the red stapler from the movie Office Space, that I keep on the shelves in sight of any video interview that I do. I used to, when I was a business school professor, I used to make references to like The Office in class all of the time. And the reason I do is like these shows are funny because so many of us work in crappy environments. So many of us work in draining environments. And I find that unacceptable. So that's sort of the real inspiration, the through line through all of my work. Now, what I found is that most people don't invite you to work with you if you say, hey, I'm going to help your office not suck. So what I usually say is that I'm trying to help the people on your team do their best work ever. The trick is that in order to do that, we need a place that sucks a bit less. Right? So I still get to do that. So that would, I think, kind of be the inspiration. And that stems way back from in college deciding to kind of pivot from writing fiction to writing this particular genre, is that I found this is something really useful. It's really useful to give people an insight into how their brain works, how teams interact, and the dynamics of relationships, especially in a working context. That's all really, really useful and also kind of entertaining instead of just being entertaining. And so that was kind of the big idea I got inspired to do. And I've been lucky enough now, it's been almost 20 years, to be able to continue to do that.
Hmm. And it's all apart. It all stemmed from that initial vision, and you're just branching out different ways to support that vision.
Yeah, yeah.
It's fantastic. Is there a who that inspired you to do what you do? Perhaps someone from your family, your earlier life, or is it just this burning desire inside to make work suck less and people do better work?
Yeah, I mean, I think we all have who's, right? You know, we talked earlier about support as a currency, right? So, you know, my 11th grade English teacher is Christine Franzim, who also encouraged me to be the literary magazine editor and the newspaper editor and et cetera. So she gave me a ton of support, right? I had instructors when I was an undergrad, grad school, et cetera. I have role model authors. So, you know, I joked earlier that like reading Gladwell was probably the thing that made me realize like, wow, you can use all of these tools of storytelling and be helpful. But then there's others, Daniel Pink and his level of blending of storytelling and prescriptions do these things. Here's the key takeaways. Roger Martin is an intellectual hero of mine, right? So you have all of those. And then, there's little smaller who's too, like, I don't know who I stole this from. It's probably one of the cliches in the writing world, but we always talk about how, like, don't write to an audience, write to a person, like construct an actual person. And so I can name them. I'm not going to do it because it would embarrass them, but I can name specifically who in my life I decided was the person I'm writing that book to. Like, you know, I'll use the most recent one, Leading from Anywhere, is about remote teams. There's a very specific person in my life I know of who was the chief operations officer about a 200 person company that early on in the pandemic had to figure out who is essential and needs to stay on site and who is not. And then how do we get those people to collaborate? And I, every single time I sat down at the computer, was thinking about how can I make this useful to him specifically? Right. So, you know, there's a lot of who's.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. You just named a few, but yeah, I mean, just like you said before, you're not the lone creator just sitting there writing these books. You're standing on the shoulders of giants, and you've got your support team, some that are alive and others, you know, right? We have our dead and alive mentors. It doesn't matter whether these people are alive or not. So that's awesome to hear that. Now,
So
this has been quite the chat, David, just like taking a peek inside of your brain, just to kind of get an idea of what your book's about, how you help leaders and teams do their best work ever. And I'm going to leave the stage open to you to share with the audience that's watching and listening. Where can viewers and listeners find out more about David?
Oh yeah. Well, real quick. Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you. Real quick. I'm going to turn it around. Right. So if you are all the way, we're at like 58 minutes into this thing. And if you're still here, you're part of a very special community. You're part of what I like to call Sean's end of the podcast club. Right. And so I'm going to assume, right, that since you're part of the club, you've already liked and subscribed and left a review for Sean's thing. If you haven't, please do that before you do anything for me, because you're part of a very special end of the podcast club. But if you're part of the End of the Podcast Club and you also want to be part of the sort of circus burkus, if we will, and also learn more about me and my work, I'm really lucky. DavidBurkus.com is a really weird name. Not the David part. That's pretty common. Burkus. There's only one other David Burkus in the world, and he's a Hungarian filmmaker. So if you type my name into Google, you're going to find me before you find him. If you switch him, by the way, and you type Burkus David, you'll find him. It's a cool trick that we established with each other. So that'd probably be the easiest place to go. From there, you'll find my website, my socials. I used to joke that I'm on every social media platform but TikTok because I don't dance. But actually, starting January 1, we're on TikTok too. So wherever you want to find that content, just search my name and you'll find it. And then, yeah, please connect with me there. Let me know you're part of the End of the Podcast Club, and I'll be happy to answer any further questions you have.
Excellent, David. This has been absolutely awesome. I hope you all were listening up to David's expertise. And just like David said, you know, if you guys are part of the special club, congratulations. You've been watching and listening to another episode of the Making Magic podcast. Feel free to give this video a thumbs up, like, comment, subscribe. This will be on YouTube where you're watching. And we're also streaming live on LinkedIn. Or if you're just listening to the sound of our voices on any one of the popular podcast apps, the show is streaming on all of the popular ones, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, et cetera, et cetera. Feel free to review and drop a comment about the show. That would be greatly appreciated. So thank you again, David, for sharing your expertise on the Making Magic podcast. And we'll see you guys on the next one.